Remakers Mark Special Episode 9, In Memoriam 2014. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remakers Mark. Here we are in our ninth special episode, which is our 2014 edition of In Memoriam. With me, as always, is Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Deathly.
Ooh, creepy. I like it. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you tonight?
Spangly.
Spangly. Nice.
Can I say it? Can I say it?
Yes.
Lee Haunted Skeleton.
How are you doing tonight?
I am just fine.
Wonderful. And Mark Josting, how are you this fine evening?
A little bit fuzzy, but otherwise fine.
Happens to the best of us. My name is Kyle Delahunt. Normally I say I will be your host again this evening, but in fact, I will not be your host this evening. For tonight, I will be handing the reins to Andy, but not yet. Ha ha ha, false alarm. Take that. So this is our 2014 In Memoriam special episode. This is our second annual, I think, right? We didn't do a 2012 one. We did a 13 and now a 14. It's weird to say that we're excited about this. I think this is a show that we like, but we don't want to like. You know, we don't want to celebrate death, but we're happy to celebrate the lives of people. Well, maybe some of us do.
Circle of life, Kyle.
Yes, Mustafa. We're happy to celebrate the lives of those who enriched the world of Hollywood, and that's what we're going to do here tonight. Andy is a little bit of the Grim Reaper of the crew here. Not he doesn't kill people, but he seems to have a itchy trigger finger, as it were, when it comes to notifying us about people who have died in the world of Hollywood. So Andy will be our host once again. He hosted last year. He did a good enough job. I deemed it acceptable.
It was sufficient.
B minus.
It was sufficient, yes. He received a passing grade of C minus or better, so good job. And now I'm going to hand it off to him again. So Andy, why don't you take it away here and talk a little bit about why you like death so much, and then what we're going to do tonight.
Speaking of adequacy, what do they call the person who graduates last in their class in medical school?
What's that?
Doctor.
Oh.
Just saying.
Funny.
Thank you, Kyle, for that cheery introduction. It's a little bit late, I think, in the canon of In Memoriam lists, but hey, we're still in the first quarter of 2015, so we're not that off the ball.
Sure. Sickness can be rough. We had some sick time, so that pushed us back a little bit, but what can you do?
A bit. But I think early on in 2014, I don't want to say we became excited for this episode, because that's horrible to say, but there were some big, big names in Hollywood that we lost this year, and so I think it just kind of naturally came to us that, ooh, this is probably going to be a tough one for us to talk about. So that's just what we're going to do. I'm excited for how we're going to do this. We're going to do a first round of picks. I think these are maybe we'll call our primary picks. We'll listen to some guests chime in with their feedback and opinions, and then we'll do one more quick round to wrap it up. We're going to start with Jer. Jer, you're going to tell us about someone who is a dear director, writer, and actor in Hollywood.
That is correct. So I will begin by just giving a list of some of my favorite comedy movies from the 80s and 90s. Animal House, Meatballs, Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, National Lampoon's Vacation, Groundhog Day, and many more. And the common thread between all of these movies is, of course, Harold Ramis, who is who I would be talking about. The more that I look into what he did and how he contributed to movies, the more I realize that he was comedy in the 80s and 90s as well. But, if he wasn't acting, he was directing, or he was writing, or even producing a movie that became a classic comedy hit. And he died fairly young. I think he was in his mid 60s when he died this year. And so, he was still making movies or being involved in movies, up until then. And, I don't know. It as much as I love comedies, I owe a lot of my favorite movies to the hands of Harold Ramis and, what he did and what he brought to Hollywood for that period of time. So
I think all of us would be able to say that we would tip our hats to this, because we came together, I think, with as a group of friends, in large part because of our appreciation for those kinds of movies. And, yeah. And so I think that all of us could easily say that Harold Ramis was a huge influence on our tastes in film.
For sure.
And I think men of a certain age, that being our age, you know, the mm-hmm. 30s and 40s, people that grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and the movies that I mentioned are probably the favorites of a ton of people. And whether we realize it or not, Harold Ramis had his hands and his brain in so many movies in the 80s and up past that as well. But I mean, that what I just listed was not even close to an exhaustive list of what he was involved in. And yeah, it's, and even before that, when he was writing for SCTV, which for my money was as good as Saturday Night Live back then. I mean, it was, he just knew comedy and he got it. And it was so groundbreaking, and so many people that are doing comedy now probably owe quite a bit to what he developed and brought to both TV and movies back then.
I would think, for going back to your comment about men of a certain age being big fans of Harold Ramis, I would think that guys, you know, 10 years younger than us or so could say the same thing about like Judd Apatow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that.
And Judd Apatow probably owes a ton of what he does to,
oh, very much,
Harold Ramis. Wasn't Harold Ramis in an Apatow movie too?
He was in Knocked Up. He was Seth Rogen's dad.
He was, yeah.
Yep.
Which is a great little homage part, I think.
Yeah. He was so great in that. Yep.
A little passing of the torch, so to speak.
Yeah.
But yeah. Harold Ramis is sorely missed. And yeah, he indubitably. That's the word. He indubitably and indelibly changed the face of comedy for forever. And I love him for it. And Ghostbusters is one of my top movies of all time. And his Egon is just a more precious to me now than it was before. And knowing that he's passed, and that character will just always be a little bit, there will be a little bit of Egon in all of us, I think, is what we said a while back.
We all wish we were Egon.
Yep. He made it cool to be a nerd, which is not, you know, back then was not a big thing. You know, this was pre Revenge of the Nerds, right?
Pretty close.
Shortly thereafter, right about the same time.
Pre Big Bang Theory, we can safely say.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So it, you know,
pre Chris Hardwick.
Yep. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
For sure. And Jeremy, I will say, you know, take this as you will. I hope you take it as a compliment. If ever there was going to be a Egon cosplayer, you would be the one.
Yes.
You look like him. You sound like him. And again, I hope that comes off as a compliment because it's meant to be that. But yeah, I mean, you are very Egon-esque in all of the best ways.
Well, gosh, I'm going to tear up. Would one of you sing Doe and one of you sing Ray real quick?
Do
Ray
Egon.
Nice.
All right, I'll be done. So I'll pass
it's good,
it.
It's good radio right there.
It's fantastic. This is entertainment at its best. Harold Ramis would probably be semi-proud of this. But I'm going to pass it over to Andy, unless any of you have anything else to say about Mr. Ramis.
No, I think that's great. I miss him already. Yeah.
I'm also jealous of your Egon cosplay thing, because I think the closest thing I can ever come to is Dr. Green from ER.
That's not a bad cosplay overall.
Nah. Thanks for trying, Kyle.
You're welcome.
I am going to talk. Oh man, I'm going to talk about Bob Hoskins, who passed away last year. Hopefully, you know who Bob Hoskins was. If you are an American, again, of a certain age range, you probably know him from his performance as Eddie Valiant in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which was a surprisingly good movie. Not surprisingly, but like, it was a really good movie. Maybe better than I think a lot of people were expecting it to be.
Yeah, it kind of came out of nowhere in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really did.
And it really holds up, too.
Oh, it does. Mm-hmm. And I think we discussed this as a group a while back, but there are some video clips out there, and Kyle, I don't know if you can find these and maybe link to them, of Bob Hoskins acting, performing certain scenes, obviously like in front of the blue screen, and then next to it is the finalized scene from the movie, so you can kind of see the raw product and the finished product. And it's just amazing to see how well this guy had to perform essentially with nothing. You know, he had to act in a world that truly did not exist and had, you know, sometimes maybe a little stick to look at that. Oh, your other actors in the scene are over here now. Look at over here. And really it was pretty incredible. But Bob Hoskins, that was my first introduction to him. And honestly, for a long time, I didn't know he was British until I think I saw Brazil, which is my second favorite performance of his. He plays a character called Spore. It's a very small role, but it's really funny. I like it. There's a little interesting tidbit that I learned about Bob Hoskins, is that he played Nikita Khrushchev, Winston Churchill, J. Edgar Hoover, and Benito Mussolini in his career. Thought that was kind of interesting.
That's awesome.
Nice. Yeah. Not
that's
all in the same.
That's range.
That is.
Yeah.
It's also a maybe typecasting. I don't know. He also played Mario in Super Mario Brothers.
Yes, he did.
Well, more technically, he played Mario because the Mario Brothers.
Mario squared.
Mario and Luigi Mario. Anyhow. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a lot else to say about Bob Hoskins, except I've really enjoyed watching him work. I've loved to see the things that he does. He had a great range, going from, obviously referencing back to Who Framed Roger Rabbit again, but to absurdist comedy, to historical pieces, to he kind of had this, I think it's an inaccurate description, but as a gruff, grumpy kind of a guy, but really that only came through in some of his roles, like, I don't know, Nikita Khrushchev, Winston Churchill. But really he had a wide, wide range. And according to legend, IMDb, his acting career started accidentally in that he went to an audition with a friend of his who was auditioning, and someone shoved the script in his hands and said, "You're next." And he auditioned and he got the part. And that's, you know, that was the rest is the history. Now, you know, the rest of the story.
Thanks, Paul Harvey.
Yeah, exactly. So, Bob Hoskins, I really miss the work that he did. I thought he was just wonderful. So there you are. Now we're going to have a long distance dedication from Mark.
Yes, indeed. And as Andy just teased, I'd like to talk to you about Casey Kasem. Who of us has not been touched by Casey Kasem at some point in the weirdest of phrasings that I've said in a long time? But yeah, I mean, he was the voice of America. Yeah, sure, he did that Top 40 radio show, but I mean, really, his major contribution to American culture was the voice of Shaggy Rogers from the Scooby-Doo shows.
Oh my God, I didn't know his last name was Rogers.
Yep. I didn't know he had a last name.
Awesome.
Yeah, and how about this one? Shaggy's actual first name is Norville.
Yeah, Shaggy's his nickname.
Norville Shaggy Rogers.
Yep, Shaggy's a nickname. He's Norville Rogers.
Huh.
Wow.
And Casey Kasem provided the voice for Shaggy in most of the animated Scooby-Doo features right up until like 2 years ago. So, I mean, this is a guy who provided a voice for one character for damn near 40 years.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
It's
yeah.
He did take a hiatus for a few years because of some, I would need to find the article again, but Casey Kasem had some kind of moral objection to something that Shaggy was going to do, and he didn't want him to do it and refused to voice him. And I'd have to find the article again to find out what it was, but it was a really interesting thing. But then ultimately he came back and continued to do it again. But there was a period of a couple of years where he didn't.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'll see if I can find that again.
Yeah. And in the meantime, Casey Kasem was not just the one voice man. He also provided voices for Transformers. And I'll give bonus points to any of you that can mention some of the characters.
Cliffjumper.
Oh, man.
Cliffjumper is one of them.
Yes.
Jazz.
Nice work.
No.
Not Jazz.
Boy, I don't know.
Grimlock.
Bumblebee.
That would be awesome. But no, the other notable ones would be Blue Streak, who's the one of the squad cars, and then Teletran 1, who was the Teletran 1 was the computer that was inside the Autobot base.
Oh,
nice.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
this is one that I didn't know, but he also provided one of the voices in the Super Friends series, and he was Robin.
Yeah, I saw that too. That's crazy.
Yeah,
I did know that, which was interesting when Batman and Robin came to the Scooby, well, on the Scooby-Doo episode, he was both voices.
Yeah. Nice. Two for one.
Yep.
It's a good deal.
Yeah. And actually, nice segue into something that I forgot. So thank you. Casey Kasem not only did the voice for Shaggy Rogers, but also a lot of Shaggy's relatives. So at least Shaggy's dad and two of Shaggy's uncles.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a family resemblance. It makes sense.
I was going to say, that's a good family reunion right there.
Oh, yeah. And he also had a radio show.
Yeah.
He was also a voice in Ghostbusters.
Was he now?
Oh, yeah.
That one I didn't know.
He was himself on Ghostbusters.
He was part of a montage. There was a little Casey Kasem clip during one of the montages.
Ah, nice.
I believe it's the, gonna tell you a story about a little town I know. That one? That montage?
I think so. Yeah, it was the one where they were... Because he's talking about them busting up this party, and then they dance with the girls afterwards.
Yeah.
Remember? Yep. Yeah, he's telling the story about what the Ghostbusters did that night.
Yep.
And nice. Then gave him a long-distance dedication. Awesome. Full circle, full circle.
Nice. Nicely done. Good work.
Yeah, I did see in his credits that he has basically parodied himself a couple of times in mostly animation, but there's a... In 2000, there was a Rugrats movie where he provided the voice for a wedding DJ. There was
perfect.
Yeah. On another occasion, he provided the voice for a radio DJ whose name was Flaky Flakem, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got to appreciate the self-deprecating humor. That's good.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, a resume like that spanning such an amazing period of time. Yeah, I posit that Casey Kasem is the greatest voice actor in history.
Yeah, and I don't think that's unfounded at all.
Yeah, and I gotta love that as a very cartoon-centric person.
Yeah.
Yep, and just a voice that probably more people in the world, alive or dead, have heard maybe than anyone else.
Wow.
You know, I mean, think of how many people tune in to Top 40 throughout the years.
I mean,
he did that for a long time. I mean, like, his voice was heard by how many millions of people every week, every other week? You know, I mean, that's amazing. Yeah.
Hmm.
Plus, not to mention that kids who are kids right now are still watching the original Scooby-Doo.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, that show is timeless, which is saying something compared to a lot of the other cartoons that were out in the... You know, the 70s, they aren't as cool now, but Scooby-Doo is still around.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's move on to Lee.
Thank you. I chose to speak about an actor who made a career of 60 years playing mostly supporting roles, and that is Eli Wallach, who I kind of discovered by accident in college when I was hunting down Marilyn Monroe movies and watching those. The first thing I ever saw him in was a 1961 movie called The Misfits that was written by Arthur Miller, starring Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe. And he was a supporting character. He played Clark Gable's best friend. And he was brilliant in it. I mean, all three of them were brilliant in it. Thelma Ritter was also in that, and she was really good too. I think that he's like one of the standards, I think, for Hollywood, that you can have, you know, an amazing career and leave behind this legacy having played supporting roles. And that's just kind of what he did. He wasn't really a leading man, but every role that he was in was memorable. And, you know, he did a great job and he worked with a lot of amazing people. The second, well, just as an example, the second thing that I saw him in was The Godfather Part 3, where he plays Don Altobello, who is a friend of Michael Corleone's and sort of in some ways, a mentor to him. And the last thing that I saw him in was a movie directed by Edward Norton called Keeping the Faith. I don't know if anyone saw that one.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah. Ben Stiller and Edward Norton and Jenna Elfman were in that. And Eli Wallach plays a rabbi who is sort of a mentor to Ben Stiller's character. There's even a moment in the outtakes when they're in the synagogue and, you know, Eli Wallach is sitting, you know, during one of the services and Ben Stiller's supposed to be, like, giving a sermon of sorts. and he's forgetting his lines, and every time he forgets something, he turns around and goes, and Eli Wallach is here, everybody, and everybody, you know, claps and applauds, and he did that several times, and I think it was because of, you know, just how well-established Eli Wallach was. Everyone knew who he was. He was a member of the Actors Studio, Lee Strasberg School. So he just had a really long, distinguished career. And it's, you know, it's sad that he's gone. But at the same time, it's like, you know, he lived a full life. And he did everything that I think he wanted to do.
Yeah. He lived in 98.
Yeah, I mean, he did do a lot of different things.
Yeah. Yep. The one, I think, sadly, I guess I've seen The Godfather 3. I don't know if I've seen anything else, but the movie that I think of for him is The Holiday, which was a 2006, like, it could have been very schmaltzy, and at points it was, but overall it was not over schmaltzed. It was, like, just right schmaltzed. And he plays he basically plays himself, which is a aged Hollywood figure who is maybe a little bit past his prime, but who everybody loves. He's like, oh, it's that guy, of course. And he ends up getting this huge tribute at the end to him as a actor. Was it a writer? I can't remember which.
I think it was a writer.
A writer. So there's this, like, the movie ends with this big tribute to him. So I could see that being, you know, the tribute that he should have been given for his time here sort of played out in film form. And he was great. He was just adorable. He was like the grandpa that you wanted, or just kind of the kooky neighbor that you wanted. But he was awesome in that. I thought he was really great.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know this until just tonight when I was thumbing through IMDb. He was in the original 1960s Batman TV series as Mr. Freeze.
Oh, Mr. Freeze.
Yeah, I love that.
No way. Yeah. Awesome.
So
that's range.
Try and find those. Yeah. Try and find those on YouTube or something like that.
You know, honestly, if I were a Hollywood actor, I would want to be more like Eli Wallach, to have played alongside all of these fantastic actors of so many genres and so many eras, and to just have been there and been with them and palled around with them to a certain degree, and just to have the range to just be that guy actor in everything from spaghetti westerns to romantic comedies to whatever else. And like, I would choose that over your leading man, Jim Carrey, doing the same thing every time.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know.
Well, and he did it for 60 years. So just imagine like the stories he would have had.
No kidding.
You know, being on the set of The Godfather Part 3 and, you
then
know,
going and hanging out with Sinatra, and then
Working with Clark Gable, and
exactly
in Clark Gable's last movie, by the way. So we should move on to Kyle.
Yeah. So the last of the big picks here is one that we certainly couldn't not talk about this time, and that is Philip Seymour Hoffman, who now it's actually a little bit over a year ago. So it was really early in 2014. So I think both Harold Ramis and Philip Seymour Hoffman died very early in the year. And again, when we talked about, you know, being excited about this, it was about being excited about paying tribute to those people who are such strong presences. Philip Seymour Hoffman was, I don't know, I wouldn't call him a character actor. He straddled the line between character actor and star, or maybe he was the star character actor. I don't know which, you know, kind of like he and the John C. Reillys of the world. And now, so I was in New York several years ago, and they were doing a two-person play together, and I didn't go and see it. And now I am kicking myself more than I've kicked myself for many things for not having gone to that. But what can you do? You don't know that the person that you admire greatly is going to pass away when they do, and so you just deal with what you can. So Philip Seymour Hoffman had a huge range. He played everything from a whiny, insecure boom mic operator in Boogie Nights to a sort of suck-up secretary in The Big Lebowski to a despisable character in Happiness. He played Lester Bangs in Almost Famous. He played one of the meanest characters with one of the greatest speeches I've ever heard in Punch Drunk Love.
Man.
The phone conversation between Adam Sandler and Philip Seymour Hoffman. The shut up, shut up, oh. shut, shut. I mean, it's I don't know what direction he was given. I have a feeling P.T. Anderson was just like, yep, go Phil. And he did that. And that's astounding. In my kind of notes here, just to try to keep this all together, I have the following movies all together, just with sort of arrows next to each other. This was within like a 2-year span. Big Lebowski, Happiness, Patch Adams, Flawless, Magnolia, Talented Mr. Ripley. And you know, he wasn't the lead in any of those at all, but his presence and his characters in all of those, like, you remember every single one of those characters, and for good reason. He just brought so much to the screen. He brought pathos, he brought sadness, but he was never too dark. He was never too sad. He always brought a humanity to the role. You know, we kind of talk about Harvey Keitel syndrome, where if you want a Harvey Keitel character, you get Harvey Keitel to play that. And he was never that. You know, that's why I say he wasn't quite a character actor, because he wasn't just himself. He was those roles, but he brought all of him to every role that he played. The one most recently that I think has brought him the most regard, he got an Oscar nomination for Capote, and then again for The Master. Those are probably the two that are his most sort of critically regarded roles. The Master was a hard movie to like. That's P.T. Anderson's look at sort of Scientology, basically. But his performance as basically the L. Ron Hubbard figure was extraordinary. He lived a pretty dark life outside of Hollywood. You know, he battled drug addiction and ultimately lost that battle with a drug overdose. But people loved him. They loved him on screen. They loved him off screen. He was a good friend. So it's certainly sad to see someone die at 46. But you know, the impression that he'd left and the number of movies and the quality of the characters and the quality of humanity that he brought to those really, I think speaks to him as a person and as an actor. So Phil, we miss you.
Mm-hmm. The first thing I ever saw him in was Scent of a Woman, mm-hmm. where he plays a high school kid who sort of embodies the rich kid hiding behind daddy's money.
Yep. He did that a little bit in Talented Mr. Ripley, too. Like, he's the one that figured it out early on, but he had that same sort of underpinning.
Yep. And he was, I mean, even then, I mean, he was brilliant in that. He did such a good job.
Yep.
First movie I saw him in was at the same era. I think it was even the same year. Leap of Faith, the Steve Martin comedy drama about the evangelist preacher that did all the drove around the country in the bus and whatever. And he was part of the crew for Steve Martin and the bus driver and whatever. And a short time after that, I saw Twister. And he was
kind of Twister, I forgot.
Pretty much the same character, like just a kind of a not manic, but a really excitable guy that's just sort of happy to be involved with everything else, and both were very small roles. But I just remember really, really liking him in both of those roles, and then I didn't see much of him until, gosh, I don't remember what the next movie was I saw him in.
Probably Boogie Nights.
Or Big Lebowski or something. But the next time I saw him, he was completely different. And I thought, hey, it's that guy. And I was like, it's not even the same guy. But then after that, because then he started hitting his stride kind of in those late 90s, in that whole little chunk of time that, Kyle, that you mentioned, in that like 98, 99, 2000, where he was in everything, Magnolia and Talented Mr. Ripley and Almost Famous and all those. And every movie, it was a little bit different character. And you either hated him or you loved him, but you were always drawn to him in every role. And even in the Mission Impossible movie where he was the bad guy, like he was probably the best bad guy that set of movies has had.
One of the better baddies of recent memory, I'd say.
Yeah, and it wasn't an over-the-top, crazy, chewing-on-scenery kind of bad guy. It was just a kind of a quiet, seething, just enough crazy, and it was so good.
Those are the best bad guys.
Yep. But, yeah, I haven't seen Capote, which I really need to do, and I haven't seen The Master yet, which I'm not even sure I'm going to do. He was really good in The Hunger Games too, which is the
it was
his last performance is that set of movies, and
Plutarch. Yeah, The Master is is a very challenging movie. I would say it's worth seeing, especially if you've enjoyed the Paul Thomas Anderson sort of style. But it's hard to like. He is really good, and Joaquin Phoenix is extraordinary. But it's a very challenging movie, for sure.
If you look at his filmography and also his stage work and realize that that encompasses, what, 20 years or less? It's yeah. It's astounding. This guy must never have stopped, which is probably what helped a drug addiction, which ultimately, you know, kind of came around. But like, yeah. he was putting out 3, 4, 5 movies a year and then doing some stage work on the side and the theater. Like, this guy just must have been just going nonstop.
Yeah.
All right. That was our first round. That was our first round of picks. To recap real quick, Jer picked Harold Ramis. Ramis or Ramis? Romulus or Remus?
I always thought it was Ramis.
I believe it's Ramis.
Do, re, mi.
We'll go with do, re, egon. Ramis.
Egon.
Sorry, you did a third and a fifth.
I'm not good at this. Jer chose Harold Ramis. I went with Bob Hot. I'm not going to say I went with. That's a bad choice of words.
You went out with?
I talked about Bob Hoskins. Mark talked about Casey Kasem. Lee spoke about Eli Wallach. And Kyle talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman. We have 3 guest picks we'd like to talk about now. The first one is going to come from Jeffrey Palmer, where he is going to discuss Mike Nichols. Let's listen.
2014 saw the passing of Mike Nichols, who was a very influential American director. Though he directed just under 20 feature films, many are regarded as absolute classics and will live forever along with his memory. I wanted to talk about 2 in particular that were very important to me, the first of which being his second feature film, The Graduate, starring Dustin Hoffman. I think one of the most important jobs of a director is to not just steer the ship, but make sure to get the most out of every person who's aboard the film and in their particular role. With The Graduate, Mike Nichols is able to capture not only the darkly comic tale of Benjamin Braddock and old Mrs. Robinson, but also create a very human story that was extremely relatable to me when I saw the film, even though I had never been through anything like a situation that the character was going through. His use of the camera was constantly locked down, very steady, and just really opened up the scene to capture the performances of his actors. I came away from the film feeling hopeful, even though in the end, it seems like Benjamin's plans may have gone awry, but that it was all right that I didn't have my future completely planned out, because you never know when an Elaine Robinson is going to come along that changes your whole perspective and gives you something to fight for. Catch 22, another darkly comic tale from Mike Nichols, featured an incredible cast from Alan Arkin to Art Garfunkel to Bob Newhart, Martin Sheen, John Voight, even Orson Welles. Finding a balance between persona and performance might have been an impossible task for a lesser director, but Nichols is able to balance his main character's performance alongside that of the ensembles to create a comedy that stands beyond the genre and certainly the test of time. From there, Mike Nichols would go on to direct such classics as Biloxi Blues, Working Girl, Regarding Henry, The Birdcage, and Primary Colors, among others. His impact on cinema will never be forgotten, and he will be sorely missed.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for that feedback on Mike Nichols. That was very, very well put. I was actually not really familiar with who Mike Nichols was until I listened to this and looked at his IMDb page, and I realized that there are a lot of movies that he made that I really, really like.
Yeah,
there's a lot of really good,
a lot of really good movies, but a lot of very widely ranging topics. You know,
yeah, yeah.
Like he went from he touched on The Graduate and Catch 22, but then going all the way to The Birdcage, which is one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, and then yeah. Closer, his second to last feature in 2004. I really, really enjoyed that that picture as well.
Yeah, I feel like you can take a lot of directors that will approach a variety of different topics. Like if you take a John Hughes, like he did a variety of different things. Like Pretty in Pink is very different from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But I feel like it always feels like a John Hughes
very
film.
Much.
With Mike yep. Nichols, I feel like that's not quite the case. It's just always a really good film. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. He was also a very well-regarded improv comedian back in the day, back when that wasn't a very well-known thing. There's lots of clips online of him just being very clever and very influential in the improv world. So that was pretty interesting, too.
Very interesting. Once again, thank you, Jeffrey. So we'll move on to our second one, brought to us by Allison Clotter, who's going to talk about James Garner.
Despite his rugged good looks and his unmistakable voice, James Garner still retained that unassuming everyman quality. He always seemed equally at home in westerns like Support Your Local Sheriff and, of course, the TV series Maverick, as he did in flimsier, fluffier comedies like Move Over, Darling and The Thrill of It All, both from 1963 and both starring Doris Day. His full range is more on display in The Americanization of Emily, in which he plays a playboy American naval officer stationed in England right before D-Day. All of this is complicated by his unexpectedly falling in love with a British woman played by an incandescent Julie Andrews. Garner's performance runs the gamut here. He's alternately dashing and funny, and as the film progresses, he really gets to pull out some dramatic stops. My favorite James Garner film, also from 1963, is The Great Escape. The film is based on true events, and it's about Allied POWs escaping from a Stalag during World War II. It's tense and surprisingly taut for a movie that runs almost 3 hours. It's also just got an absolute murderer's row cast. Steve McQueen's in it, Charles Bronson, James Coburn, David McCallum, and also Richard Attenborough, who passed away in 2014.
Kudos to you, Allison, for your use of the adjective incandescent to describe.
Yeah, I thought that exact same thing. And it's perfect for Julie Andrews.
And also, thank you for tying into Richard Attenborough, who was another one of the celebrities that we lost last year. Did not make the cut for this episode, but I always loved him in Jurassic Park.
There indeed. Mm-hmm. And as the narrator for Planet Earth.
So good.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
right.
So good. Finally, our last guest one comes from Kate O'Reilly. She's going to talk about probably someone that I think we all wanted to talk about and were, I don't know, if we ever felt like, I think there was maybe a reverence issue where we didn't feel like we could talk about it. I don't know. Maybe I read too much into that.
Yeah, we're not worthy.
But anyway, Kate is, and she's going to talk about Robin Williams.
I first remember liking Robin Williams while watching Mork and Mindy reruns in the basement of the house I grew up in, sitting cross-legged on the maroon paisley carpet of our family room. I really liked his face. He reminded me of my dad. I liked that he was goofy. He made me feel like being weird was okay. I always felt weird, and I liked that he seemed to embrace it. Good morning, Vietnam. Balanced acting like I had never seen before. Awakenings, fantastic in so many ways. I still haven't stopped thinking about it. Dead Poet Society, which came out exactly when I needed it to. The Fisher King, more perfect than I think we'll ever know. The Birdcage, taught us all to embrace who we really are and laugh while we do it. Good Will Hunting, I have a soft spot for emotionally capable men, and Williams did not leave me hanging as Sean Maguire. He lent his deft ability then to Happy Feet, Jumanji, Robots, and the Night at the Museum series, all of which I watched with my boys, encouraging them to be silly, expressive, emotional, and heartfelt. I watched the episode of Louie he did after he died, which was so, so sad and eerily perfect. Robin once said, "I don't know how much value I have in this universe, but I do know that I've made a few people happier than they would have been without me. And as long as I know that, I'm as rich as I'll ever need to be." I imagine Robin Williams fought for as long as he could. Rest in peace, Robin. And thanks for the happiness.
We're back, and we're all a little verklempt from that really lovely tribute from Kate. So I think she...
Yeah, Kate... That was an amazing eulogy.
Yeah, she put into very clear and wonderful words what a lot of us would have made a sorry attempt at. So, wow, way to go. We miss you, Robin.
A worthy tribute. Yep, indeed.
She put it very beautifully how I feel about The Fisher King. It's a movie that very few people will realize just how good that movie is and how good he was in it and how much of Robin Williams is in that movie. And that's why it's one of my, if not the favorite movie of Robin Williams of mine.
For me, his apogee will always be Awakenings, just because it was so far in the opposite direction of what he had done up to that point.
Yeah.
It was just brilliant. And he was so good with Robert De Niro. Yeah.
When he passed away, and the Twitterverse exploded with tributes to him. My favorite one came from Sesame Street, and it was a screenshot of him with maybe it was the two-headed monsters. I forget. But in the picture, Robin Williams is wearing this very brightly colored, loud plaid shirt. He's got a big, huge, bushy beard. And he and the Muppets that he's with are just leaning back and full belly laugh. And it's just like, it's just such a picture of joy. And that's that's how I like to remember Robin Williams.
Yep. You're here. Yeah, indeed.
Now, let's move on to our second round. Let's lighten this back up with some more death talk. Lee, tell us about your second pick, because honestly, it's not someone I'm familiar with.
Well, I've got another supporting actor here, James Rebhorn, who has had a very long career of playing sort of antagonistic roles.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, he always played someone who was kind of working against the main character. First thing I ever saw him in, although I don't remember this very well, was Stephen King's Cat's Eye.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very short role. He plays like a businessman or something like that. The next role that I saw him in that I actually do remember was My Cousin Vinny, where he plays, I believe, a forensics expert who testifies. And then the first really memorable role of his was Mr. Trask in Scent of a Woman. He plays the headmaster who's trying to expel Charlie for essentially not, you know, giving up his friends when they vandalize his car, and he wants to know who did it. He knows that Charlie knows, but Charlie won't say, and he stands up for his principles, much to Mr. Trask's chagrin. The result is a very long Al Pacino monologue that kind of tells him off.
Classic.
After that was Carlito's Way, where he plays a district attorney. And it's a very long list. Independence Day, he plays the Secretary of Defense, The Game. He's in the series finale of Seinfeld.
That's right.
I mean, he's done everything. He was in Meet the Parents. So, I mean, he had a very, very long career. I mean, a lot like Eli Wallach in that way. You know, he made a very solid career out of being a supporting actor. And I think had he lived longer like Eli Wallach did, he was only 65 when he died. But had he lived longer, you know, I think he probably would have surpassed what, you know, the number of things that Eli Wallach appeared in. Again, you know, just a very brilliant actor, did a lot of amazing stuff, and tended to disappear into all of his characters. So, and case in point, people didn't know who I was talking about.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
He was,
he was a pretty typecast guy, and he was always kind of the district attorney or the police chief or the, you know, the guy in charge of the whatever that's going to mess up the main character or whatever, the judge, the, like it was always, like you said, Lee, the in charge of whatever the organization was that was working against the main character.
He had a really great quality for an actor, as there's a little bit of a sniveling edge to him, you know, like just kind of looking out for his own skin to a bit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy though that the last role that, at least that I know him for, that I think a lot of people probably do, is the dad of Claire Danes in Homeland. He's very caring. He suffered from bipolar disorder in that role. And he took a role that could have been sort of a stereotypical bipolar sufferer, whatever that means. That can mean a lot of different things. It can be written really poorly and performed really poorly. And he rounded it out. He was just a very caring dad who had a daughter that needed a lot of caring as well. I like that he wasn't the district attorney for that last role that most people know him for.
Exactly. But let's move on. Kyle has our next lightning round or shorter pick.
Yeah, my pick is Jan Hooks, who most of us will know as a cast member from Saturday Night Live. She started off She had a lot of different work before SNL. She was part of the Groundlings, which is a well-loved comedy troupe. But she started Saturday Night Live in 1986, which was the same year that Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman started.
Wow.
So that's a pretty stellar freshman crew. Yeah, that's big time. So she was there until she joined Designing Women in 1991. She took over for Jean Smart, who is one of the kind of the three main characters. She went on to do lots of different roles, probably most notably Third Rock from the Sun. But her work on SNL was, I think, that which most people know her for. She, to me, was very similar to Phil Hartman. She didn't, I don't think she was given as many memorable roles as Phil Hartman was, but in terms of range, in terms of consistency, and in terms of the energy that she brought every week, she never had a bad role. You know, she might have had a bad performance. She might have had one that was not well-rounded or it was very one note, but she just brought it every week and she was great. The one that I remember was her impression of Tammy Faye Baker after the Tammy Faye Baker scandal, and she's just weepy and just makeup dripping everywhere. Oh my God, it's just amazing. Like, just willing to go to whatever lengths was necessary, as is needed in SNL, and she did it beautifully. I just thought she played kind of like the mom role as well as the slightly off-kilter roles. I just think she did wonderfully. So she died on October 9th of this year, so we'll miss you, Jan.
She was kind of like that class, that Saturday Night Live class or generation's Gilda Radner.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah.
I think she had that kind of comedic range and she was that good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and if there's a cast member now that I would compare her to, it would probably be Kate McKinnon, which I think is high praise.
I'd say it's like half Kate McKinnon, half Vanessa Brayer, because Vanessa can play kind of that mom role that Jan Hooks would sometimes do. But yeah, I absolutely. Mark, on to you. What is your lightning round pick?
For my last pick, I'm going back to the well of cartoons because that's what I do. And I'm going to talk to you about Christine Cavanaugh. She's not exactly a household name, but her characters definitely are. The said characters are few, but they're very high profile. Most notably, that of Babe the Pig from the movie of the same name. Yeah. It was a 1995 film, which is just beloved by pretty much everybody. Where she voiced the little pig that became a sheepdog,
like you do.
Yeah, as you do. she also had other really important voice acting roles, such as Dexter from Dexter's Laboratory, and I don't know. I feel like that series should be better known than it is. And especially her work in it really, really set it apart. Because what she brought to this character made it so unique. Where you have this little kid that's a super nerdy scientist, and you know, you could do all sorts of stereotypical nerd voices, but she did this strange kind of lilting, drawn out accent that sounded like it could be from East Europe, but who knows where it actually was from. And it's nothing like you ever heard before, and you can only imagine what type of creativity it takes to come up with something as you're auditioning for a role. I guarantee that the casting directors didn't hear anything close to what that performance was when they were auditioning for that role. Christine Cavanaugh also provided the voice for Chucky in Rugrats.
Aww.
And in the same year, the voice for Goslin in Darkwing Duck, which is close to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Christine Cavanaugh died at the tender age of 51. She was really influential in the voice acting world, brought so many unique characters to a variety of animated features. She will be missed.
Indeed.
Let's move on to Andy.
For my second pick, I'm probably going to talk about more than my first pick. I chose Joan Rivers, who passed away last year, born Joan Alexandra Malinsky in Brooklyn. I will readily admit that I had a pretty low opinion of Joan Rivers until 2012, 2013, just because I really hadn't paid a lot of attention to her career, and mostly I knew her as this highly modified lady who gabbed at the red carpet and was kind of a running joke. However, I saw a PBS documentary called Make 'Em Laugh, which is kind of a history of American comedy. And they spoke about a lot of the pioneering female comedians of the 20th century, and Joan Rivers was among them. And I really learned quite a bit about her history and how she was a fantastic comic, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Was a great writer in a lot of ways. And really, her acting career is kind of secondary. She did, I mean, if you look her up on IMDb, if you look up her self page, there are, I think, over 300 credits. So she was on a lot of talk shows, a lot of other shows. She hosted shows. She guested on shows, blah, 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 blah. But in her acting, she would often play herself or a parody of herself. She was very self-deprecating. She was very self-aware. She knew who she was and she knew what people thought of her, and she didn't care. She was a funny, funny lady. I think that most of us, going back to the men of a certain age and women of a certain age, but really probably more men, would know her as Dot Matrix from Spaceballs in 1986. Mm-hmm. She will always be Dot Matrix to us. She also played the perfume saleswoman in The Muppets Take Manhattan. Little known role. Nice. I thought it was a fun little tidbit that apparently she started performing on the stage under the name of Pepper January. Probably a good idea that she changed her name, unless she really wanted to get into film industry or something. But I mean, she was a writer, she was a producer, she was a director, all these things. I after seeing that documentary and then kind of doing a little more research on her, I was really very impressed at her career. She worked up until the day she died. You know, apparently those who were close to her on her staff, that she was a wonderful boss. She was just a great person who I think the world was too casual and too cruel towards in a lot of ways, but she never really let it get to her. And I applaud her for that. So Joan Rivers for my second pick.
Hear, hear. I won't go into it too much, but listeners should research the story of her guesting on Johnny Carson and then basically being shunned by Johnny Carson as well. It's a fascinating story, and it just goes to show sort of her spirit and the challenges that she had being a female comedian. But well-deserved praise.
Finally, Jer, finish this round off.
Sounds great. I'm going to finish off with probably the most prolific actor or actress of the ones that we've talked about, and that is Mickey Rooney. He started his acting career at the ripe old age of 17 months back in 1924, I believe.
Probably 21.
And, thank you, 1921. But shortly after that, when he was just a wee lad, and this is instead of going through his filmography, which would take us a while, I just want to start with a quick story that his first big role, his parents, because he was three or four at the time, saw an ad in the paper for looking for a kid to play this Mickey Maguire role in a series of short films based on a comic strip that required a kid with dark hair. He didn't have dark hair, so his mom, who was also a poor vaudevillian, put burnt cork on his scalp to make his scalp dark, and he ended up getting the role. And his name was John Yule at the time, his birth name, and ended up changing his name after doing 70 some odd of these cartoon or these short films based on the comic strip in order to beat out a copyright lawsuit. They actually legally changed his name to Mickey Maguire, and then he then switched it to Mickey Rooney shortly after that. There is a urban legend that he claims that he met Walt Disney, and Walt Disney changed the name of Mortimer Mouse to Mickey Mouse after meeting Mickey Rooney. Walt Disney says that it was his wife's idea, so who knows what's true and what's not on that. But Mickey Rooney, from the 1920s to a few months before he died this year, has been working in Hollywood, and that to me is astounding. That he has gone through. I mean, look at what movies were then and how many different eras of cinema that he has worked through and not given up from, you know, going through the age of Technicolor and even to the point of movies pre-sound and getting into the talkies and then into color film and into the digital age. And like he's seen it all and been in it all. And that to me is just amazing that his first role was back when vaudeville was still a thing. And his last role was Night at the Museum 2 or whatever it was.
He actually has a movie in post-production right now that's coming out this year.
Yeah. When he was 93 when he died, and he was 93 when he was doing his last acting. And that's insane. And he worked with all the greats. I mean, he was part of the Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra sort of variety show era. He did voice work. He did. He was on The Simpsons one time. He's been on Broadway. He's done it all. The role, just to wrap up and not be too long winded, but the role that I will always remember him from is the Black Stallion, which. Take it for what it is as a movie. It's a fine movie, but it was one of the first movies that I saw because I didn't watch a lot of movies as a kid because we didn't have TV or anything like that. So it was a rental movie or something that was on a CBS afternoon special or whatever back in those days. And my mom loved horses, and we lived on a farm with horses, and that movie was just so great. And he was the wise old teacher in that movie. And that movie came out, what, 40 years ago? And he was the old guy in that movie. And he's still rocking it up until 2014. So God bless Mickey Rooney and his long, long career. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he worked with Joan Rivers and some of the other people that we've had on this list, too, because he's just been everywhere and
done
it all.
He's been dead now. We're going on 10 months.
Died in April, yep.
I bet he's already got over a dozen credits in heaven right now.
The first thing I ever remember seeing him in was a made-for-TV movie called Bill, where he plays a mentally challenged elderly man, and I believe he won an Emmy for it.
Yeah, I think that was one of his first big things, too, if I remember my research correctly.
Yeah. But I remember being really lost in that story. Like, I was 7 when I watched it, and I was kind of glued to the screen, and I just thought it was a great, great show, great movie.
But he worked with Judy Garland. He worked with Spencer Tracy, and then, Elizabeth Taylor, Audrey Hepburn, and then into the Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin years, and then into... new cinema and all that. He was the voice in 4 different of the classic Christmas specials. Santa Claus is Coming to Town, The Year Without a Santa Claus, a couple other ones. And he always played Santa Claus in those. Like I said, he was on Simpsons. Like, he was just everywhere.
He was the standard by which other actors judge their prolificness.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, all right. Thanks, guys, for wrapping up that second round. I get to do the closing analysis. Kind of exciting.
You do. And I get to say, and also with you, I'm so excited for that.
We're both going to screw this up, Kyle. We're both going to screw it up.
Yes.
I'm unmuted already. I'm ready.
All right. So thanks for tuning into our 2014 In Memoriam episode. You can visit mathishard.net for show notes and check out all the other podcasts and blogs on the Math is Hard. See, I screwed up already. On the Math is Hard Network.
And also with the...
you can visit us on the social networks. Look for Math is Hard or Math is Hard Net. Our next episode will be released on Monday, March 9th, where we will be discussing our first For Shame episode with a discussion of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Gentlemen, may the force be with you.
And also with you.